Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about film pioneer D.W. Griffith, who Charlie Chaplin referred to as the teacher of us all because he brought so many film techniques to the film industry. So Mike, let's start off with how does a young man from a small town in Kentucky end up becoming D.W. Griffith?
Well, the important thing to keep in mind actually are his birth date and his death date. Why do I say that? He's born in 1875. He dies in 1948. He literally straddles the 19th and 20th centuries. In some ways, Griffith is very regressive. By that, I mean his father had been a Confederate officer. He grew up with that lost cause ideology, as we refer to it, very much a son of not just Kentucky, but of the Old South, if you will. And when we, in a little while, talk about Birth of a Nation, that becomes so immediately relevant, doesn't it? But just a sense of those origins, socially very conservative, we would say even reactionary in some ways. And when we talk about his full career, it's a little more complicated than that. And I always say Griffith as a man, in terms of his psychology, was either very complicated or very confused. There's maybe some combination of the two. And we can get into that in a little while. But back to those origins, that's where he comes from. And those values really are essentially 19th century values from a particular time and place. One reason why, even in his own day as a filmmaker, in terms of his stories, his character types, and so on, he's rather old-fashioned. And we'll talk more about that in a while, but he really comes out of that. Now, that's what we might call the regressive aspect, or just a man of his time and place. The progressive aspect is what you and Charlie Chaplin, good company, referred to. Namely, that when you look at film as an art form and as an industry, Griffith, who's often referred to as the father of film, really was in a lot of ways. He really made Hollywood, Hollywood. I guess he and Cecil B. DeMille would want some credit too. There's some other people doing that. But as we talk through his early career leading up to the Hollywood epics that he would make, he really is the one who does not necessarily invent camera technology and possibilities, but certainly incorporates and synthesizes them. In other words, sometimes people mistakenly say he invented the close-up, he invented, you know, parallel editing, all these things. Well, no, he didn't actually invent those things, but he recognized them and very quickly utilized them and joined them together, melded them into what we now take for granted in terms of cinematic narrative, how stories are told on film. So that's the progressive aspect of him. And again, any discussion of Griffith, at least for me, it always involves bouncing back and forth between the regressive and the progressive and trying to make sense of it all.
You know, I think it's important to point out that, you know, before film actually became a thing, you know, if you wanted to become an actor, your choices were, you know, the stage. And that really was kind of it. It's not like you could say, well, you know, I can always go into TV or, you know, I can always make commercials. I mean, really the only thing, the only game in town was to actually be on the stage. And there was a lot of, it had a bad connotation to be a stage actor. So it was considered something sort of disgraceful, like a way to, good families didn't do this sort of thing. And this was the prevailing attitude of regular folks, but also Griffith's own family. So why do you suppose he was able to sort of overcome that to not just, well, I mean, it took him a long time to succeed as an actor, but, you know, just to have so much to offer once he finally did get to Hollywood?
Okay, the thing to keep in mind here is that everything you say about stage actors having a low reputation, for the most part is true, but by the same token, you also in that era had Sarah Bernhardt. You actually had really major theater stars who were held in very high regard. So it's a little more complicated that way, but I would say in general, I would agree with you that stage actors didn't have the highest reputation. And yet it was so popular to go to the theater that a lot of people made their living that way and did respectably well and at various levels became respectable. Griffith, in his own case, now begins as an actor and as a playwright. As a writer, he never quite makes it. I mean, he does publish, he has some recognition. It's really more as a stage actor that he gets recognized. And one of the interesting ironies is, to your point that stage actors didn't have the highest reputation, neither did filmmakers in those earliest years, right? And in terms of film audiences, it was considered sort of a low-class entertainment. The snooty upper crust would, you know, not deign to go to the Nickelodeon, if you will. So when he enters the film industry, that would not have been an obstacle because I would wager, in fact, historians have charted this, that the majority of talent coming into the nascent film industry was coming from the theater. Makes sense, doesn't it? Whether you're a stage actor, director, you know, set design, carpenter, all those things, that transfers quite readily. Secondly, the center of the American film industry in the very late 19th, very early 20th centuries, the center of that industry was New York City and, believe it or not, Northern New Jersey. I always like to laugh about the Meadowlands being the Hollywood of that day or something. But, you know, Thomas Edison had his studio facility in Northern New Jersey. The American film industry, specifically Biograph, which was the studio that Griffith would go to work for in 1908, that it was located on 14th Street in Union Square. That's Lower Manhattan. It was in a converted brownstone mansion. And what had been the ballroom, that was back when rich people actually would have a ballroom. The ballroom on the first floor was converted into the movie studio. So when Griffith was trying to get into the film industry, he initially approached Edison's company with kind of mixed results. But where he did have a breakthrough actually was with Edison, specifically with Edwin S. Porter, the director who had made Great Train Robbery in 1903, considered the first Western, one of the major directors in that first decade who was working for Edison. So Griffith had hooked up with him. I mean, they had, you know, a connection. And what happened next was that Griffith was hired as an actor. And he appeared in a film for this company, for Edison's company, called Rescued from an Eagle's Nest. It was directed by Porter. And I've seen it. The storyline's incredibly hokey. It's like, you know, there's a baby. And for some reason, known only to God and I guess the director, and screenwriter, well, they didn't have screenwriters even, but whoever came up with the scenario, for some reason, this eagle's going to swoop down and kidnap the baby and take it off, not just to a nest, but a nest on top of a craggy mountain. Somebody's got to go up there and rescue that baby. Well, you know, the actor who actually climbs the peak and rescues the baby is D.W. Griffith. Now, bear in mind, this is an Edison film. It's 1907. He's an actor. And yet he acts as he did on the stage. The wildly melodramatic gestures and all that. And again, he's going to bring a lot of that to his earliest films. He's marked by that. Again, it's, I would say, a kind of regressive aspect. He's still acting as you would on a stage, but he is acting and now for the camera. 1907. So within a year, by 1908, he is working for Biograph there in Union Square, Lower Manhattan, and makes his first film, The Adventures of Dolly. And I've seen it, and it's got, again, got a very hokey, melodramatic storyline. This little kid and her family are quite well off, actually. They live in a kind of pastoral setting. And this gypsy comes along, and again, they're really stock character types, stereotypes, we'd call them. So the gypsy is marked as the villain just because the person's labeled as a gypsy, right? So anyway, the gypsy has a falling out with the family. The gypsy decides to kidnap Dolly, the kid. I'm laughing because it's so hokey. And eventually, without spoiling anything, you can assume it's a happy ending and they'll find the kid and justice done and all that. But so the storyline is very much par for the course for what you could play out in a novel or in a stage melodrama that year. However, the technique is quite rudimentary, and yet he's already thinking up aspects of the chase, of the pursuit. How do you take the story forward? You know, the kid's kidnapped, the family's looking for the child and so on. And it's rather crude in terms of film technique. And yet you have to bear in mind that Griffith had absolutely no background in filmmaking. This is like decades before film schools, but even in terms of like working in the studios, he had only started working in movies the year before as a stage actor, now with a camera on him. So we'll talk some more about this, but this is the transitional point where he goes 1907, 1908 from being an actor to being a director. And I'll just quickly add that he does occasionally appear as an actor in some of his own early films as a director, but that quickly subsides and he's just a director slash producer at that point.
So, you know, a lot of people who get into film at the very beginning, you know, they think in terms of directing the play on the stage, and, you know, the temptation is just to set the camera up and start rolling. So it's worth noting that he did, even if he didn't, wasn't the first to do them, that he used so many interesting techniques that we, you know, we've seen a million times now, but just imagine how unique they would have been when he first used them. You know, the idea of doing the long shot with the panorama, you know, fading in and out, using that iris, using a mask. I mean, how many times have you seen the shot where somebody is looking through some binoculars and then you see it as if you're looking through the binoculars with the mask? I mean, all of these things, you know, you had to sort of imagine in your mind when it hadn't really been shown to you a million times. So he gets credit for at least trying, you know, innovative techniques.
He deserves
in
all
how
of
many
that.
450 or something?
Yes,
how many movies did
say,
he make with Biograph?
With Biograph, he was with Biograph from 1908 to 1914. And ends up at the very end of that phase with a feature-length film. We'll talk more about that. But for most of those years is making one-reel films, or even what were called split-reel films, just 5 minutes long, 10 minutes long. I think it's a great film school education. Every week you're making not just another movie, but he was making on average about 3 movies a week, I mean, for much of that stretch. So if something doesn't work, it's not the end of the world, right? The next day you're on a different project. And sometimes he actually was working on the film simultaneously, because depending on weather conditions and whatever else, if they had outdoor work to do. So he's got all that going on, all that in his mind, and however disordered that mind might be in some ways in terms of in terms of ethics and politics and all that. Brilliant by way of his cranial prowess. What do I mean by cranial prowess? He had all those ideas in his head. He was not working with scripts. Nobody really was at that early point. You had situations, you had scenarios, you had like shooting schedules, but you're not really what we would call a script. So everything, not just the storyline, but the camera placement, all those things, he had upstairs here, right? I mean, that's a lot to have in your head. So every week making a few movies, and everything you just mentioned by way of technique, he's learning as he goes along. He learns the most technically from his preferred cinematographer, Billy Bitzer. And having read Bitzer's autobiography, it just bolsters everything I'd known already about Bitzer. Bitzer really taught him film technique, and Griffith respected that. You know, even though he was the big director, he would sort of pull aside and they'd whisper back and forth, and Billy Bitzer would say, well, let's try this lens, or why don't you set it up there? You know, the light levels are better and so on. And so he greatly respected that. Now, to your point about everything he was innovating, it was not an easy process. It's kind of stop and go sometimes. Watch the earliest Biograph films, and sometimes they're really like impressive and almost amazing by way of things you mentioned in terms of, you know, cross-cutting, parallel editing, use of the iris and other masking techniques, alternating shots within the scene. Other films are quite static and literally stage-bound, almost with that metaphoric proscenium arch over the scene. And sometimes mm-hmm. the films are all the above. What I'm getting at is Griffith oftentimes, particularly in the early films, even in his later films, frankly, would have an interior scene that might as well be on a stage. The camera's at a neutral distance. He only maybe once or twice cuts within the scene, sometimes doesn't cut at all, because the earliest films for everybody tended to be single shot scenes, didn't they? Like we go to the next scene and like watch, you know, Great Train Robbery or Rescue from the Eagle's Nest. You know, there's a lot going on and there's narrative construction, but each scene itself typically has a fixed camera at a neutral distance. Griffith persisted in that, and the interior scenes, they're cost effective in that they didn't spend a whole lot of money on these productions. And so sometimes the sets really do look like what they are. It's like painted flats in the background and just, you know, a few pieces of furniture pushed into the room. And even for people who are supposedly like wealthy characters, it's like, geez, couldn't they afford another sofa? You know, but it's pretty, you know, low budget. We got to get this thing made. So anyway, that when you see a scene like that in an early Biograph film, you think, you know, this really isn't much removed from, you know, just turning on the camera and shooting it as you would on a stage. That's what it is. However, in that very same film, when they cut to an exterior, it suddenly will have all the above, everything you just mentioned in terms of innovative camera work, including moving cameras sometimes. And what they would do is they would shoot in the studio in Lower Manhattan. And then depending on weather conditions and depending on the scenario they were working with, outdoor locations typically were found in Northern New Jersey, and across the river, you know, you can get to all sorts of near wilderness, like the Palisades, just across the river, just across the Hudson. If you need a cliff, the Palisades has cliffs. If you need a dense forest, it's right there. You know, you just go across the river and there you are, wilderness. They also, of course, would go into New York State and they would find a lot of bucolic, really pastoral settings. A lot of the camera work, a lot of just the cinematography, the staging, the mise-en-scène, is brilliant in those exteriors. But then it cuts from that to the stodgy interior where people are just standing, waving their arms melodramatically on what really is just, it's the ballroom converted into a movie studio on 14th Street. You know what I mean? And it's just really, it can be frustrating sometimes. And so it's like fits and starts, stop and go, as I call it. But, you know, working through that, there are some great short films that he makes in that period, among the 450 of them. And then certainly by the early 19-teens, he's really mastering it. And the films, even for the interior scenes, become a bit more creative as to how he uses the space.
You know, at the time, you know, that these are shorter movies, you know, by our standards today, they weren't, you know, the medium was so new that they weren't even sure whether watching longer movies would hurt your eyes, which of course is my lead in to a very long movie that D.W. Griffith did eventually make and is most well known for, which is 1915's Birth of a Nation. So Mike, tell us a little bit about why, tell our listeners why this movie is both fabulous and terrible.
Okay. Now, Griffith in 1914 made his final film for Biograph. Judith of Bethulia is a biblical epic. It's a feature-length film. And it's a little under an hour, but you know, it's what would be considered a feature film. Cast of Thousands, Sword and Sandal epic, all that. He had been watching Italian films, which actually were in advance of our own film industry at that point. Films like Cabiria and Quo Vadis and so on. If you watch them today, those are the underpinnings for a Cecil B. DeMille biblical epic, you know, with the Cast of Thousands and a quasi-religious story and a sin and salvation kind of an ethical structure for it. And Griffith had seen these films as they were opening in America, and he had a good healthy arrogance. In other words, he told himself, you know, I can do that and I can do it better. So Judith of Bethulia was sort of the trial run to make a big scale picture. His studio, Biograph, balked at that. Biograph, in its own way, was quite regressive. Biograph preferred the short film format. Biograph felt that audiences wouldn't sit still. Some of the earliest feature films in the early teens were actually made to be shown in installments because theater exhibitors and distributors were convinced that people wouldn't sit still for that long. So you could see like part one for 10 or 15 minutes, and then you come back the next night and they'd show you part two. So these are films by other directors, but that thinking was predominant at the time. Griffith was one who insisted on, no, the film's going to run an hour or 2 hours, and you're going to sit there and watch the whole thing. There might be an intermission, but you're going to watch the whole thing there. Secondly, Biograph was regressive in the sense that in its earliest days, even though certain actors were used repeatedly, it refused to give screen credit to either actors or directors. One reason was it felt the public didn't care. It just wanted to see the stories. A second reason was the Biograph management reason that if it had to put the names there, the screen credits there, wouldn't it have to pay the people more? In other words, it actually was afraid of the star system. And so audiences started to notice one actress in particular that they dubbed the Biograph girl, because they thought, well, you know, I saw her in a movie last week. I like her a lot. Here she is in another movie. And the studio initially, for the longest time, refused to give out her name. Can you imagine nowadays, like, refusing publicity? We will not identify her. So it was Florence Lawrence, who was only with Biograph for a while, but things change a lot by the early teens. Griffith works through that and convinces management, you know, to rethink some of these issues, and eventually leaves Biograph. That's his way of really responding to them. And Biograph will disappear as a studio shortly thereafter. So anyway, 1914, he makes Judith of Bethulia, and it's a box office success. Griffith is getting a name, he's getting a reputation. With Birth of a Nation, this is where you see Griffith at his most pronounced in terms of regressive in some ways, progressive in others. Birth of a Nation is based on a play and turned into a novel by a man named Thomas Dixon called The Klansman. I actually own a 1915 edition of the novel. So, and it actually has photos inset of what they called the photo play. Since movies often were referred to as photo plays back then, and so it actually has illustrations from the film, photographic stills, we'd call them. And having read that novel, it's the most racist novel you would ever want to read or not read. And this is like the most backhanded of compliments in terms of the racial content there. When Griffith filmed that novel, he actually toned down the racism a bit. Believe it or not, because when you watch Birth of a Nation, it's such an incredibly racist movie. It's like, how could anything be worse than that? Believe me, if you read the novel, you know, brace yourself, because it's just shocking, beyond shock even, as to what this novel is page by page. The Klansman was a great stage success, and it dovetails with Griffith's background, barnstorming, taking a play city to city like that. The Klansman was a huge stage success. The novel form of it was what we'd call a bestseller. It was natural subject matter for Griffith in at least two respects. One is he has like a property that's well known. Wouldn't people want to see the movie version of something that's been so popular, just at that level? But then secondly, the content of it, the regressive, racist content of it, appealed to Griffith. There's no other way to put it. The essential storyline is this. There is a white family in the North There's a white family in the South. They are friends before the Civil War. The war intervenes. Each family does its duty. You know, you fight for the South, you fight for the North. When the war ends in 1865, from Thomas Dixon's perspective, that was such a calamity that the white South had been defeated. And then that Reconstruction was so shameful from his perspective that Union troops, because after all, the only reason that the South was brought into the Union again was because it was occupied territory. The Union Army occupied the South starting in 1865, soldiers on the street corner, if you will. So the freed slaves did gain some rights, obviously, in terms of being free to begin with, you know, being able to own property, run for office, and so on. There were some political gains made and to some extent economic gains. However, from a white Southerner's perspective, this is the beginning of what's known as lost cause ideology, what the South had been and what the South could regain after the disputed presidential election of 1877, which if we talk about that, we'd go on for hours because the most recent presidential elections we've had don't hold a candle to this one, believe me, as bad as it's been, you know, like in 2000 or now potentially in 2020. There was a lot of cutting it short, just to get to the essence of it. There was a backroom deal that was made because Samuel Tilden, the Democratic candidate, and Rutherford Hayes, the Republican candidate, were so closely, almost tied in terms of votes and most crucially electoral college votes, that it was really a toss-up as to who had won that election. Essentially, a backroom deal was cut. Hayes, who again, he's a Republican, but he assures the Southern Democrats and so on, those electors, if they throw their votes to him, he will strike a deal whereby if he's elected, the Union Army will be withdrawn from the South, okay, which it was. So that's the election of 1876. By 1877, so again, the election itself, of course, is 1876, but 1877 is the more crucial year in terms of the aftermath, that then the Union Army is withdrawn from the South, and state house by state house, the defeated white Confederates regain power. So Reconstruction had lasted 1865 to 1867. And after that disputed election, presidential election of 1876, everything changes. In the last few decades of the 19th century, the infamous Jim Crow laws, things like that are enforced. The Supreme Court upholds the doctrine of separate but equal in Plessy v. Ferguson, 1896. All those things are happening then. Now, where does that pertain, or how does that pertain rather to us? Okay. The Klansman, and certainly the cinematic version of it we're talking about, and actually it was filmed under the title The Klansman. The title was changed to Birth of a Nation just before it opened in New York. But in the novel and play and film, there's a little bit of action taking place just before and during the Civil War. But most of the film, and it's a three-hour film, there's an innovative aspect right there to make a three-hour film. Most of the three-hour film takes place during Reconstruction. 1865 through 1876, 77, in that period. And the most important and horrifying thing to realize here is that as the white Southerners regain power, the shock troops for that, in the vanguard of that, if you will, is the Ku Klux Klan, which is presented as the hero in this story. They ride to the rescue. At the end, it's got one of the most famous chase scenes in terms of riding to the rescue and parallel editing. And again, on a technical level, it's brilliant. On a thematic and ethical level, it's horrifying because this is a case where the Klan is coming in to preserve the integrity, the purity, specifically of white Southern women, but in general to preserve the Southern values and make sure that that wins. So again, in terms of subject matter, it was something, you know, very topical for that era because people were still fighting or refighting the Civil War. We are today still. Look at the controversy with Confederate monuments and all that. We're still fighting that war in some ways. Imagine what it was like in 1915 when so many veterans, both of the North and the South, were still alive, and families who had directly been involved in the war, their parents and grandparents had been. It was an active issue. I've often contended that even though the Confederacy lost the Civil War, lost in a political sense, ultimately it won. Ultimately, it really, really, you know, regained power, and it won the war of popular culture. Look at the biggest films of the first half of the 20th century. You know, Birth of a Nation is the box office champion. Amazing performance at the box office everywhere, North and South, everyone going to see it. When it is finally knocked off its throne as the box office champion, what's the film that does that? Gone with the Wind in 1939. Another film that is pro-Confederate. You know, there's no way around that. It really is showing you the story from the Southern perspective. So we should talk more about the film, but those are some of the political and I'd say sociological underpinnings for the success of Dixon's play and novel and then of Griffith's film.
Well, in 1915, it would have been the 50th anniversary of the end of the Civil War. So I'm sure that Griffith thought the timing for this is just perfect. But, you know, truth was, even though it did play for huge audiences, everybody went to see it, possibly more people than have seen any other movie. There were riots, too. You know, it was a big thing. And in 1941, when Griffith was interviewed for a biography, he said he thought that the film should be kept from the general public, seen only by film people and film students. What do you think of that?
Well, first of all, in terms of the film's release in 1915, it was enormously controversial. And there were protests. In fact, if there's a silver lining here in terms of the racist content and so on, if there's a silver lining to that, it's some of the protest and the backlash, if you will. For instance, the NAACP had only been founded in 1909. It was an interracial progressive organization. It was still, you know, very young and just finding its way. One of the galvanizing forces for the NAACP was to set up picket lines, city by city, to protest Birth of a Nation. But this is on the other hand, kind of equation. On the one hand, yes, it should be protested, you know, that kind of protest. And there were riots, actually. Yeah, you're absolutely right. In some cases, theaters, were threatened. There were some cities that actually banned it from being shown there. But so on the one hand, there's that protest, which should be there, obviously deserved. On the other hand, that kind of what you might call negative publicity can very quickly morph into positive publicity in the sense of people know about it. They hear about it. Gee, I got to go see this movie. You know, I'm getting at that. It just in the way that, you know, publicity is a tricky kind of thing because, you know, if somebody stands up to condemn it, somebody else will say, well, what's all the fuss about? I should go see this. And, you know, just simply as a movie, it's entertaining. I mean, by entertaining here, I put quotation marks around that, but it's simply that it's a massive film, 3 hours, all sorts of interwoven storylines, all the film technique in the world beyond what people had seen before, huge cast, huge budget, production value like you wouldn't believe. It's all there. So it's worth your money at the box office just as a viewing experience. Now, how people responded to it, that's going to vary, whether they loved it or hated it. Certainly enough people loved it to make it the box office champ, right? If everyone had gone and said, what a terrible film in terms of content, it would have died at the box office. So enough people accepted it at some level, whether they agreed with all the politics or not, they accepted it at some level. Griffith himself, when the film came out, he was obviously happy about the box office performance, and he had a more than healthy ego. And he was suddenly, you know, the most famous filmmaker in America. He was a public figure. There was a screening of it, a private screening of Birth of a Nation at the White House. President Woodrow Wilson was arguably one of our most racist presidents. You know, there had been some gains made at civil rights during Reconstruction. Even later in the 19th century, the federal workforce, to some degree, was desegregating and so on. Wilson, among his other nefarious accomplishments, actually pulled the plug on that. So even though the federal workforce had been integrating to some extent, Wilson in the early teens, when he took office, reversed that, and the federal workforce was segregated again. So there are ways in which you can empirically prove that, you know, Wilson was really racist in terms of his politics. And as part of that, I would say that one of his friends was, guess who? Thomas Dixon. Dixon and Wilson, you know, they had academic connections, they were friends and so on. So anyway, a private screening of it was set up at the White House. And one of the most famous quotes in film, all of film history, was Woodrow Wilson supposedly saying, I think he did probably say it, but there's been some dispute, Wilson saying that the Birth of a Nation was history written with lightning, and that famous quote from Wilson. What better publicity, and I put quotation marks around almost everything I'm saying here, what better publicity for the film than the President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson, you know, praising it like that to all of America. Griffith himself, you know, because he grew up with those values, really just thought he was depicting it as it is or as it was, right? He was just at that level of, well, that's how it was. And, you know, he agreed with Dixon there. What changes in Griffith, and again, the complicating wrinkles or the confusion, when the film came out and there were the protests and there were the riots, Griffith was startled by that. He was confused by it. And he actually said, no, I'm not a racist. You know what? Why would anyone watch this film and think I'm a racist? I mean, go figure, right? But this is how he initially responded. And to his credit, the very next year, we'll talk about Intolerance, but for the moment, just to say that it's a film that is protesting against prejudice, against racism, against all those isms that we'll be talking about some more. So the very year after Birth of a Nation, he makes an even bigger film that is a great humanist statement. And it is, really. I mean, Intolerance really does qualify that. And in the later 19-teens, Griffith makes a number of films, Hearts of the World, Broken Blossoms, others yet, some of them directly tied into World War I, that we could, I think, justly call pacifist films, films that are arguing, you know, against war, against racism and religious prejudice and all that. So Griffith's own attitudes, you know, change a bit over time or get modulated or moderated a bit. And to jump to the very end of the film career, and I don't want to say too much more about it at the moment, but his next to last film, Abraham Lincoln, which comes out in 1930, his first talkie actually, presents Abraham Lincoln as such a hero that he's saint-like. I mean, there's a kind of sanctified quality to it. This is the same Abraham Lincoln who would have been a villain or a villainous figure in the worldview of Birth of a Nation, right? But here in 1930, it celebrates Lincoln as someone trying to keep the Union together. This is all coming from the same filmmaker. So again, has he evolved as a person, Griffith, or is he somehow still confused? So it leads up to your quote from 1941, when yes, you're right, late in life, Griffith tended to talk very differently about the racial content of it. And I want to give him the benefit of the doubt here, because based on some of those later films and based on statements like the one you cited and some that I could cite, Griffith really seems to have had a change of heart. I don't get overly sentimental here, but I think Griffith really does sort of moderate or even rethink some of his positions.
Well, that actually takes up all the rest of our time. But don't forget to look for our other podcasts on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.